It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Yeah, we're not afraid here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day here in the afternoon on Liberty News Radio. And I tell you, I got a special guest for you today, Bob Proctor. Now, Bob Proctor, I've known for years, had him on the radio. We've had long conversations about many things, but I tell you what I want to talk to you about today. Bob Proctor runs a page called Elliott Wave. Now, we're going to talk about Elliott Wave. We have a limited amount of time with him, but I want to make sure that he gets the concept out of what Elliott Wave is and how it applies to what's going on right now. We have, around the world, there is an implosion, and a lot of it is based on the concept that people thought that they would be able to do some math. You got some Yale grads, they come in, they say, hey, Mr. Banker, man, we're going to have this algorithm, we're going to do some math, we're going to do some algebra, we're going to decide what we can do with everybody else's money, how we're going to make money, and this says we can, right here. Push the button. There it is. But it's all based on certain facts that they just assumed was going to carry forward in their variables and how they applied to human behavior. Well, this is where Elliott Wave and Bob Proctor come in. They have known for a long time, and this is how he makes all his money, helping other people make money, because they understand one thing. Human behavior is a variable, and it doesn't stay the same. It changes over time, and it has an enormous impact on what happens in financial markets because of just what people believe, their moods, and this has a cycle. Welcome, Bob. I got you there?
Yeah, you sure do.
You know, Bob, can you do that for us? Go ahead and explain to the audience what Elliott Wave is and how it applies, because now we got a lot of these people coming out going, oh, man, your math was wrong. And the thing that they were wrong about is they weren't paying attention to you.
Well, they weren't paying attention to human beings. I think that's a big problem. You know, it's one thing to develop theories, as economists love to do, with lots of formulas and numbers. And every time you read one of their papers that has all the formulas and numbers about how the macroeconomy is supposed to behave, they always say, assuming everything else is the same, and then they go on from there. But as we know, things in human societies are never the same. One thing that's always for sure is change, and people change their behavior dramatically from one era to the next. This is what those models didn't take into account. It killed a lot of hedge funds, killed a lot of endowments among the major universities, and it's going to really devastate a lot of pension plans in this country because people had this assumption. Anyway, the brief summary of the wave principle is that the market is actually not the result of news hitting it left and right, and it doesn't rationally readjust. It moves up and down on waves of optimism and pessimism, waves of social psychology that are on their own. They're internally regulated. It's the way people behave in a social setting, and those waves of optimism and pessimism induce people to buy and sell stocks. They also induce people to do a lot of other things, expand their businesses or contract their businesses, put out a lot of loans, pull in their loans, and even in the cultural area, pull certain books off the shelf, go to certain movies, watch certain TV shows. And that's what makes certain types of popular entertainment popular at different times in the cycle. So there's a whole lot to talk about. The main thing is, you know, human society is a very interesting thing. And when you're in the economic realm, going into Kmart or Walmart or the grocery store, you're in the economic realm where you're being rational. But in the financial realm, it's all social mood.
Well, let me go in. I want to get some details out here. You have, a couple dozen people. I mean, this is what they do. They analyze this. I mean, so you're dealing in fundamentals, I would imagine, have some kind of impact on individuals, don't they? I mean, is it fundamentals is something that creates this mood, or are those fundamentals a byproduct of the mood? And explain that. The wave theory is that the markets are a numerical representation of the interaction of 6 billion people. And there's not a dang thing you can do about it. It's just that these people are going to react to a certain stimuli, and you can graph it. And if you know what to look for, you can predict it. How far off am I?
Well, you've just about nailed it. What most people say is that the market is reacting to the news events. It always strikes me as interesting. They never ask where the news comes from. News comes from psychology, too. Why did people have a peace treaty this year and start a war the next year? Why is the economy just soaring one year and they're calling it a new economy, and a couple of years later it's in the tank? These things come from the way human behavior changes too, right? So for them to say, it's just like an outside force coming from nowhere and it's going to change people's mood, makes no sense because they don't have causality for why these other things are going on. The theory that I'm using, called socionomics, says, is at least, whether you believe it or not, want to accept it or not, is complete. Because it said, once as social mood changes, it creates social actions, which show up as news and what other people call fundamentals. This is why people who follow the stock market are always ahead of the people who follow the economy. Stock market's a leading indicator because mood is actually causing people to behave in a certain way that shows up later in the economic figures. So we don't have to say, well, we don't know what's, precursor is. That's it.
Well, you've given details on this, and it seems like you're doing well enough that your book, Conquer the Crash, is still on Amazon doing well. Why? I mean, what is it that you're sharing with people that they don't get from somewhere else? I mean, why? We've done shows in the past. I've met you. We did a show back, I think, in 2004 or something, and you predicted exactly what was coming because you looked at it from, it's just a manifestation of what people. Is it subconscious? Is there some we go in cycles as human beings, as a market? Is the market an organic thing? I mean, explain that to me and tell us a little bit about your book.
I think it is definitely unconscious, and it's a very powerful, primitive herding impulse that everyone has. In cave days, it was very useful because if you followed the herd, you generally got out of trouble. And it works pretty well in modern societies in some cases. If everybody's running down the street, you might want to follow them in case, Godzilla's around the corner or somebody just blew up a building or whatever. But in the world of finance, if you let your herding impulse take over, you're going to make all the wrong decisions at the wrong time. And almost everyone herds. Almost everyone herds. It's really amazing. And that's why in 1999 and again in 2006, 2007, even in 2005 when real estate peaked, you could see every indicator telling you the herd was at an incredible extreme of optimism. All their behavior showed this, from stock market behavior to lending behavior to economic behavior, all the way down the line. And we said, look, this is an extreme. It shows up in our Elliott wave model as well. This is the fifth wave. That means it's where people ought to be the most optimistic. Guess what? All the indicators are saying they are. So I think one reason Conquer the Crash is selling well is because there aren't any other books out with the same message. Not one on the shelf in any bookstore, basically said, look, stocks, commodities, and real estate are going to collapse all at the same time because we have an underlying deflationary problem coming up.
Okay,
Everybody's talking about hyperinflation and runaway inflation, and mine is completely the opposite.
Okay, now this is a discussion that you come up in a lot of discussions. People say hyperinflation, here comes hyper. Well, except for guys like maybe Miss Shedlock or yourself, Bob Prechter's been saying this for a long time, going, nope, it's going to be depression, big depression. And of course, if you look at it the way it is now and a lot of things, you're right. Is there a chance of inflation? I mean, after the deflation and they keep printing money, I mean, you're thinking there's a chance of inflation coming or no?
When I wrote Conquer the Crash, at the end of the introduction, I said, I see no alternatives to a massive deflationary outcome. And if this makes me a one-armed economist, so be it. everybody's always saying, well, on the one hand this, or maybe this will happen. But the buildup of the greatest credit, ocean of credit in the history of man, and by credit, of course, the flip side is debt. People owe so much that it can't possibly be repaid, and our entire monetary system depends on what people owe. We only have $2.2 trillion of base money, and we have something like $50 trillion to $500 trillion of IOUs, depending on how you count them. So the ocean of IOUs is so much bigger, and the promises of dollars are so much bigger than the actual dollars, that I believe we're going to have an implosion in credit that is going to be swift, dramatic, and way past the ability of the central bank to inflate. There's so much more to say.
Let's go ahead and hold it for the segment.
They're already under fire from their own governors and Congress about what they're doing.
Well, let's go ahead and hold it, because we've got to go to the break. When we come back, Bob Prechter from ElliottWave.com, and I'll tell you how to spell it when we come back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, from beautiful Phoenix, Arizona. It's very nice here now. Hope it's the same where you are. Probably not as nice. We have Bob Prechter on the line from Elliott Wave. That's ElliottWave.com. Two L's, two T's. Now, Bob Prechter, he's a graduate from Yale University in the early 70s with a degree in psychology. Now, how did you come from a degree in psychology to all of a sudden you going, you know what? I made me a bunch of money with this. I understand something. I mean, how did this come about that you embraced wave theory?
Ed, that's an interesting question. When I finished school, the last question they asked us is, why do you want to be a psychologist? And I sat around and thought about it. I said, well, I really don't want to be one. I was interested in music. I was interested in finance. And I carried around my charts, and I was reading technical newsletters and learning about market analysis on my own. And one day when I got my job in Wall Street down in Merrill Lynch, I realized that the market was all psychology and that I hadn't wasted my time at school after all, and began to meld the two, because mass psychology is behind all of these market moves. You can look at any indicator that's supposed to give you so-called fundamental value, whether it's what the dividend yield should be is reasonable, or the price-earnings ratio, or the book value to the price, and you'll find that they swing so wildly over 100 years that it'll be a 20 or 30 times multiple of the indicator. Obviously, there's no such thing as equilibrium or fair value. It's all the emotions of people driving these prices up and down. They don't have a benchmark against which to measure them. It's only a matter of, do I think I need to sell stocks today or buy stocks? They don't care about the value, the price, the dividend, nothing. We certainly have been watching it for the last 10 years on the upside as people are creating all these bubbles and going completely bananas, way, way beyond anything that Graham and Dodd ever dreamed of in terms of overvaluation. Guess what? Over this coming decade, we're going to see the flip side. We're going to see undervaluations that shock people.
Wow. So I have to ask you, as you look at these waves and what's underneath them, the fundamentals, that has to have some kind of impact on people's purchasing decisions.
No, none at all. Not when it comes to finance, because the fundamentals come from those decisions. Remember, everybody was just fine back in 2005. Nobody could see anything wrong with anything. And then suddenly, the lenders in the real estate market started to pull in their horns, and people started to borrow less money to buy houses. That was the beginning of the end. It was a change in psychology, a change in outlook that began to kill the real estate market. It wasn't anything obviously fundamental. People always look at the fundamentals afterwards. Take 2000 and 2002. Very, very interesting. We didn't have a recession until we got into 2001. That was well over a year and a half after the decline started. We had an attack on the World Trade Center, which occurred a year and a half after the bear market started, not at the top. And the market bottomed 6 days later and then rallied for 6 months. So obviously none of these fundamental events are causing prices to do anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, does it have something to do with, you're looking at the Federal Reserve, banking policy, them creating money. We got, all kinds of stuff like that. None of that has any impact? I mean, it doesn't affect our mood at all?
No, the mood is affecting the Fed. The mood got so positive over the last 15 to 20 years that the Fed decided to start allowing unlimited credit. It had never done that before. It told the banking system, you don't have to keep any money around. Just do the sweep at night. Lend everything you got. We're okay with that. So the social mood was completely running what the Fed was doing. Now Congress is so mad at the Fed. They're holding hearings, and they're all angry at the SEC, and they're mad at the Fed, and they're mad at all these institutions that they set up. And now they're calling them to the carpet. They're going to start restricting all of these people's lending activities. They've already begun to restrict the banks.
And it's all based on their mood.
Agency and tell them what they can't do anymore. It's hilarious because they're causing, or their psychology is now fitting into my whole forecast, because I'm saying we're going to have deflation one way or another, and they're stopping the lending every time they turn around.
Okay, now let me ask you this: we looking at gold, all right? That's a now it's an indicator or something. You know, it's shooting. You know, what are we looking at in the future? I mean, and why? Is it there's no fundamental? It's going to be a. What does your wave say about the price of gold? Tell the people. We're going to look at what?
Look, first of all, I want to say I'm a gold bug. Gold is the only real money. In Conquer the Crash, I gave five reasons why people had to own some. That was back when it was in the 300s. You couldn't talk people into buying gold when it was 255. There was an article in Barron's that said nobody wants it. The mines are hedging everything they have. Nobody will lend the mines any money unless they're hedged. It was a classical bottom. Right here, you got the complete opposite situation. And the reason gold is at a new high all by itself. Notice oil's not a new high. Copper's not a new high. Platinum's not a new high. Silver's not a new high. Nothing's at a new high but gold. The reason is that back in 1999 to 2008, it didn't go up as much as all these other markets. It lagged. So now we got one left that everybody can focus on, and it's all by itself. We've got two back-to-back days this week of 97% bulls among traders in the futures market. That has never happened since they started keeping the records in 1987. The last time we had a single day reading of 97% bulls was $30 before the high in 2008 when gold topped at 1033. So here it is, a little over $100 higher, and people are more bullish now than they were then. And last time that happened, it dropped to about 700 from 1,000. So I think there's that kind of risk today for people who are waiting, finally deciding after it's more than quadrupled to buy the stuff. It's not a good timing to do it.
Okay, so you're anticipating that gold's going to take a dump.
I think gold is going to be lower by the end of 2010, yeah. Now, it's possible that it could do what oil did and have a blow-off first. You know, oil was at $90 and looked crazy. It ran another $50, almost 60, to 147.5 before it finally got crushed down to 33.5. But 90 was still a bad price to own it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Nobody wanted oil at $10. Actually, we put out a very special issue saying when it gets down to $10, you want to buy it because it's going to go to new all-time highs. And that's based on the Elliott Wave model. That's exactly what happened to oil. By the time it got to 90, we were flashing the caution. And when it was, you know, 120, everybody said, oh, you guys are wrong. You don't know what you're talking about. So we got a blow-off, and then they got absolutely trampled. Well, maybe that'll happen in gold. I don't think so. Usually markets turn when people are this optimistic.
So we're going to have maybe it might, you know, shoot up a little bit, hit 1,500, and then boom, going to dump.
I know. I don't think that's going to happen. I'm just saying it's not impossible.
Okay, but you're knowing that it's going to be less than what it is now eventually.
Yeah, now I'm going to say something to really upset you and your listeners. When gold was down at 255, everybody hated it, and now it's gone up more than four times, and everybody loves it. The time to buy it is when everybody hates it. There's only one market in the world that everybody hates right now, as much as they hated gold at 255, and that's the dollar. I think the dollar is going to go up all year in 2010.
Really?
Yeah, and not because it's a bullish environment. It's because the credit is going to implode so fast that whatever's remaining is going to go up in purchasing power. So
what about
this
silver?
Is what the whole deflation thing is about. It's going to fool almost everybody.
And what about silver?
Silver's lagging like crazy. It's probably the single worst investment of the last since 1980 when it topped at $50 an ounce. It's one of the few things that in dollar terms couldn't even climb to a new high. It couldn't even climb to 50% of its old price. We've got 95% bulls in the silver market with 97% bulls in the gold market. It hasn't even gone above 2008 high. There's something wrong with silver, and I don't think it's going to go to $500 or $1,000 an ounce like all these people are saying. It can't even get up to $20.
Do you think it's going to go
up? I'm not interested. There are too many bulls in silver right now.
Wow.
But not only that, we've got deflation facing us in 2010.
So I need to go out and sell all my precious metal?
No, not at all. If you read Conquer the Crash in the gold chapter, it says you must own some gold, and I recommended bags of silver coins, junk silver coins, because when the crisis really hits and you can't get your money out of the bank, and nobody listening to this show should have any money in a U.S. bank except spending money. It should be in Treasury bill funds. But you're going to need something like silver. You might need some silver to buy your everyday stuff. So that's very important. Hold on to whatever you've bought in the past. But this is a very bad time to follow everybody and be buying at $1,100. We'll buy it again lower.
Got chickens? We need to just survive this thing. Bob, thanks for coming on. You know that we could have gone on and on. I told you it'd go fast, man.
Yeah, it did go fast. You're right, Ernie.
You know, I appreciate you coming. Well, next time, think about longer.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Independence of me, Ernest Hancock. And how do you declare your independence? It's real simple. You go, I declare my independence. But you know what you got to do? I tell you one thing. You are not going to be able to declare your independence if you're dependent. What are you dependent on? Well, I don't know. You need to rely on yourself, and then you can start talking about declaring your independence. Well, there's another independence-declaring kind of guy out there. Let me tell you, Stuart Rhodes from Oath Keepers. Surprise, surprise. Here we have Stuart Rhodes from Oath Keepers. It's oathkeepers.org. And I got you there, Stuart.
How's it going?
I'm more than a wonderful, and you?
Doing fine. Thanks for having me on.
You know, we worked out a deal. Stuart, he's going to be speaking at the Freedom Summit, freedomsummit.com. Go there and you'll see lots. We'll be adding his name later today. And I tell you, there is a large contingent that would love to hear what Stuart has to say. But I got to ask you this, Stuart. There's a line. The Freedom Summit has always been from, this is our eighth one. This is the third one that Congressman Ron Paul has spoken at. A lot of the support for the revolution and the funding and the energy coming out of here from Phoenix was the result of our summits that we had coming up to now. And I'm telling you, there's a lot of people that just still voting. I mean, you know, if you think voting is going to make you free, they're of the opinion that you haven't been paying attention. So where are you at? Is there something to save? Are we going to, you know, Oath Keepers to defend this Constitution? Is this a last-ditch effort? Is this trying to get something? What is it that is your mission? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, you can look at this as kind of like the Ron Paul revolution for the military. And we hope that we can turn the tide and restore the Founders Republic through political means. But in case we run out of time, that's the point of Oath Keepers, is to be a stopgap and prevent the pulling of the plug, the final destruction of the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and hopefully to buy us more time so we can do it peacefully. So, but you know, of course, we're also talking about a very peaceful solution, too. All we're asking the police and military to do is stand down. We're not asking them to do anything more than that, to simply stand down and refuse to be tools of oppression.
Hopefully
the people can take care of everything else. You know,
I've heard this before. It was Jack McLamb here from Phoenix. I remember, you know, we've had him on several times. I did like a five-part series on my old show back in 03, 04 just to get his entire story out, because he's a very interesting individual, kind of along these lines. His whole thing was he had books that he had done, Vampire Killer 2000. We had the police and military against the New World Order. And he started this back in the 80s, I think it was. And he made it very clear. He goes, look, as a highly decorated Phoenix policeman, he was the original officer friend. And what happened, he made it clear to everyone. He goes, look, I know what's going to happen. Sooner or later, they are going to ask that the police and the military be the tip of the spear for this new world order. He goes, here it comes. How do you think this is going to be enacted? Who's going to be the one standing there? That's why we did this campaign. Support first responders that say no to mandatory shots. And we put these banners all over the place because we knew if we didn't defend their right not to be injected with this government elixir, they're less likely to give a crap whether I get it or not. So we really emphasized that and pushed it. And a lot of times we had a lot of communities here, police and firemen, that just said, no, we're not taking it. Ship it back. We're good. So you know, we get kind of a W on that one. But I'm telling you, you have the same mission. You're trying to encourage these first responders, these law enforcers, these military, the guy with the trigger, and say, you know, can we not shoot the people? Let's do that one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, throughout history, obviously, the final order comes down to someone standing there with a gun in their hand. And historically, the result has been, you know, too many times they just follow orders and do what they're told. But the founders put something in our Constitution, as clever as they were, they put in Article 6 a requirement that all officers at the federal level all the way down to local dog catcher has to swear an oath to the Constitution. That's a very powerful tool for us, is to remind them of that oath, remind them that it's to the Constitution itself, not to any man or woman, not to any position. And once you remind them of that, as long as you can educate them on what the Constitution requires as far as limitations on their actions, if they have any moral courage whatsoever, they'll do what's right. You just have to make sure they understand the Constitution.
Well, so do you find that they do understand it? They take this oath? Do they take it seriously? Have they even read it? I mean, what's the percentage here? What are you looking at?
Some do and some don't. We can't take it for granted. I mean, look, they're products of public schools. What's taught in public schools today? They teach the history. They teach the Constitution. They teach any of these hard-won lessons, learned lessons? No, they don't. And so that's why we can't take it for granted that they know it. So that's why one of the things we're doing right now is a drive to put pocket constitutions and an oath keeper's handbook that we're writing in the hands of current serving. So our goal is to make sure they understand the Constitution. We're going to encourage them to read it and, in fact, memorize it. We're challenging them to memorize the Declaration of Independence and memorize the Constitution. And so our hope is that we can remind them that their oath is to the actual, you know, highest law of the land, not to a person. And that they have an obligation to refuse unlawful orders.
Okay, I apologize. Let me ask you this question. When you say oath to the Constitution, if somebody sat down and read the Constitution, until you get to the Bill of Rights, man, that thing sucks. It's all about the power, the power, the power, the power, the power. Power eminent domain, the power of taxation, the power of commerce control, the power. Heck, if I was going to be king, I'd want that one. You know, I'm good. But the thing is that the anti-federalists of the day, the libertarians, they go, no, 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 no. We see where you're just giving a strong central government here. Let's put all the 10 thou shalt nots of government up there. So when you say, I swear allegiance to and will uphold what? I mean, define that.
Well, the Bill of Rights is part of the Constitution. So, yeah, I mean, it wasn't perfect. I mean, you're right. Guys like Alexander Hamilton and even Madison back then, when they went to the Constitutional Convention, which was supposed to only be amending the Articles, they did want a nearly omnipotent national government. They believed it could be trusted. But men like George Mason and Patrick Henry and others kind of put that genie back in the bottle, so to speak, by insisting on a dual sovereignty system, which is what we have. I mean, Hamilton didn't get his way. He wanted a unitary national government with no state sovereignty. He didn't get that. So what came out of the convention was a compromise. And that compromise, you know, as Hamilton tried to sell it in the Federalist Papers, is don't worry, your rights are protected. You don't need an actual explicit Bill of Rights to protect these rights because the government lacks all power to abuse them. Well, thankfully, no one listened to that. You know, the people of the United States, of the states, insisted on a Bill of Rights. So, yeah, the Bill of Rights reinforces what came out of it. That's what the Ninth and Tenth Amendment says. You know, these are not your only rights listed here. The government doesn't give you rights. It only protects the rights that free exist, and it only has the powers granted, and all others are reserved to the people. So, sure, that's the crown jewel of our republic is the Bill of Rights.
Well, I the reason I ask this is because as much as I think there's a lot of good people in the police and military, and there's a lot of bad guys. It's like they cultivated them, they recruited them. And the one thing that I really look for is when they even mention the Constitution or what their role is or how they're supposed to behave. Now, they're like, you know, that's just, a, you know, we got all kinds of ways to get around that. We don't care. They don't even know. And when they do know, what part of it are they really supporting? I just need to get a feeling from you, having met with, interviewed, talked with the very people that you're trying to convince. What are you convincing them of? They need to be supporting what? What is it?
Well, it's the things that we talk about in our Declaration of 10 Orders we will not obey. There are certain lines in the Constitution that shall not be crossed. One of them is respecting state sovereignty. Another one is respecting the rights of the people to keep and bear arms, their right to be free from warrantless searches, and their security and their property. I mean, these are all reflections of the Bill of Rights themselves, which were reflections of the founders' experience of abuse under the King and Parliament. And so all we're saying is that there are certain things that are done, kind of like what Naomi Wolf pointed out in her book. The leftist Naomi Wolf pointed out that there are certain steps that are done in any oppressive regime. She's right. I agree with her on that. But we're pointing out that the founders understood this. The Bill of Rights is nothing but a reaction to their life experience and the historical record that they had seen. They wanted to make sure these things were not done. They suffered under warrantless searches. They suffered under denial of jury trial and being whisked away, the extraordinary rendition of their day. You know, all these things that have been done, unfortunately, since 9/11 especially, a lot of the claimed powers, they experienced that. And so they try to stop that from happening again. That's what the Bill of Rights does.
When we come back, we'll talk.
Is really focusing on the Bill of Rights.
Literally, okay, when we come back, you're going to push the button on us, Stuart. When we come back, we'll get that thought finished. In just a little bit, we'll be right back.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Independence of me, Ernest Hancock, and on the line, my new friend, Stuart Rhodes from oathkeepers.org. Now, Stuart, I want to give you an opportunity to finish your thought there. We have an entire class of citizens that are now, because I'd like to still call them, you know, they're people. You know, if they got a gun and they're there to serve the people in various different functions, they would like to have them think that they're an elite or they're set aside or they're just tools of the man, you know. But if we approach them, and we do that here, support first responders that, you know, fill in the blank. And the reason is because if we don't have them as part of us, well, then they're part of them. You know, I vote them be part of us. And the best way to do that is to get them to recognize and to, I don't know, take an oath and keep it. Now, what do you think?
Exactly. I mean, we start with the Declaration of Independence. That's why we encourage them to read that first, because that lays the philosophical groundwork. The only justification for government is to defend your rights, like Congressman Paul has always said. And when the government goes beyond that, as the Declaration states, then it violates its only purpose. It's the only just purpose. And so, I mean, I know some folks out there are anarchists and believe we shouldn't even have a government at all, but if you're going to have any kind of a government, any kind of a state, then it should be limited to those purposes. So that's the bedrock. And then, so we start from there and say, look, this is your purpose, is to be a defender of their rights. That's it. Not an enforcer of whatever law happens to come down the pike, regardless of whether it's moral or not. And hopefully, apply the Constitution strictly, you can prevent the government from violating people's rights, or at least minimize the violation. So that's our goal. I mean, look, another thing to think about is this. The founders, their answer to the question of who shall guard the guardians was the people themselves, as the militia, should be their own security. They didn't believe there should be a large standing army, and at that time there were no professional police forces. You had a sheriff, and then you had the people who would answer the hue and the cry and respond, or they'd go pick up buckets to go put out a fire. You know, they'd answer the call. There's no such thing as a free lunch. So when you give those responsibilities for your own personal security and your own personal welfare, turn it over to professionals, that's when you get what we have now, a large class of professionals who do this for a living. And it's a double-edged sword. It's the same question the founders had about large standing armies. But it's there. There's not a large standing army, both in the sense of the professional military and also in the sense of professional police. And so we want to minimize the danger from that by encouraging them to be, you know, very strict constitutionalists and to take their oath very seriously.
Let's imagine that you're extremely successful. You have everybody. Oh, absolutely. You know, we need to, you know, all oath keepers. We got everybody in Iraq wearing badges. We got all the people here going, yep, uh-huh. And then you have the legislature, and they say, dang it, man, these bunch of Constitution-following law enforcers are becoming peacekeepers, damn it. And we need them, so we're going to hire Blackwater. We're going to get private security. We're going to do the Capitol Police is going to be contracted to the man that blah, 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 blah. You see my point? There is yeah. Then we're going to need them to kind of defend us against these private security guys. And so, because I can see the mindset of the evil hordes of with the power of the vote in some legislative body, and they are going to get what they want. And if they can't do it through the people that you want to go after, they'll do it with something that may not be so beholden to such an oath.
You mean like a private security force as powerful, as well-funded as the military?
Yeah, see, now you're thinking what I'm thinking. And I think it's interesting and important what you're doing. I just want to make sure that we understand. You know, I know how these guys think. As soon as, because I've seen it happen with Jack McLamb. He went down this road, and he's still doing it. And I'm telling you, I am of the opinion that bad guys will continue to be bad, and that until we have this oath-keeping of the people, I mean, that we have a change in culture, that we understand what we insist these people uphold. But I think what you're doing has been a very powerful weapon in educating people that aren't police officers and aren't military. And the leadership that you're taking on this and that a lot of these individuals take has an influence on the people. But does it give the people maybe a false sense of hope? Or are we using it as education? I mean, you know, I can see the double edge on this. You know, right. We're going to get them good so they can support this thing that's devouring us, this government thing. And I'm just, when you come to the Freedom Summit, you're going to be looking at a whole anarcho-capitalist kind of still voting. You know, I mean, I'm, you know, how are you going to address that?
Well, I'm going to say the same thing I always say is that, look, we don't sugarcoat anything. We had Commander Cunningham, the author of the 29 Palms survey, we had him speak when we were invited by Committees of Safety to attend the rally on Lexington Green, April 19, 2009. One of our speakers was Lieutenant Commander Guy Cunningham, who did the 29 Palms survey, asking Marines whether they'd fire on American citizens, among other questions. So we don't sugarcoat it. 24% said they would. You know, and he was shocked by that. But, you know, actually he wasn't, he was concerned about this trend of indoctrinating them to just follow orders. That's why he did the survey. But he was still disappointed by that. So we don't sugarcoat it. We do say, look, there are some who will follow orders. It's a historic fact. But we want to tip the scale on the side of those who will not, because that's also an historic fact, is there are people who will stand up and do what's right. We want to tip the scale on that side.
And so they weed those guys out.
Thing. We want to create strategic uncertainty in the mind of anybody among the political or banking elites, frankly, in this country, who would try to pull the plug on the Founders Republic. We want to create uncertainty in their mind about whether or not their orders would be followed. We want them to blink.
Oh, you know, that's a powerful argument too. Let me get this, you know, for the audience. A lot of people, they may not know you personally. We've just talked. I'm glad we're going to get to spend more time together and doing it today right now. But let's get a little history on you. You got an interesting background yourself. I mean, I would think that you got some street cred with these guys.
I think so. I mean, I worked for Congressman Paul in 98-99. I was a frequent poster on Claire Wolf's mental militia files or Claire Wolf's files discussion board. And when she decided to stop writing for SWAT magazine, she asked me to take that over. And I wrote for SWAT magazine for 2 years. She's just now taking it back over again. So, yeah, I think I have pretty good street creds among libertarians.
Well, what's been, you been in the military?
I was a paratrooper in the Army. That's right.
Yeah, you know, paratrooper. I mean, you know, you got a little bit going on with these guys. So I have to understand one thing. As you talk to these people, I was up in Las Vegas. I was there. I happened to be there that weekend. You know, Sheriff Mack was up there and invited me to just stop by and say, yo, what's up, and pass out some cards and shake your hand, and I had to come back. But I got to meet some of the people there, and I got the impression that generally the average age is a little bit older. They understand this a little bit more. Are you having an impact on younger recruits, the younger people? Because if you're in Iraq and you got guys wearing Oath Keeper patches in Iraq, you know, they're younger guys. How are you penetrating the younger market?
That's what we're doing. I mean, we're doing the best we can. We've got a couple of guys who just came back from Iraq. One of them's name is Tim Ray. He's our southern Nevada liaison in the military. He just came back in 2000. He was there 2007. So he's recently returned from Iraq. And so we're doing the best we can to reach them all. You know, whether they're stationed here or abroad, and whether they're involved in the war in Iraq or Afghanistan, we're trying to reach every one of them.
To do what? I mean, just to cause, like you say, the pause on the policymakers, the bad guys.
Stand ahead of time, and this is, when we focus on the big stuff, on the more. Some people say, "Oh, you're being paranoid. You're talking about concentration camps, and you know, as though we're predicting these things are you know happening right now, or that they're imminent." The main point is to get them to draw lines in the sand on things that would lead to another American Revolution. So we'd like to see it not turn that way. We don't want to see that happen again. We don't want it to be necessary. And so we want to make sure that they think about it in advance. But look what happened in Katrina. You don't have to wait for internment camps. You can have something like in Katrina, where you had people who were confined to a stadium, weren't allowed to leave, and we had average American citizens disarmed. You know, there was a blanket order that went out from the chief of police of New Orleans that no one would be allowed to have weapons. And so there was mass disarmament in Louisiana during Katrina, as though the Second Amendment was suspended by a bit of bad weather. And so it does happen here. And one other thing is, if we gave an award, one of the guys we gave an award to at our conference was a young cop from Pennsylvania, Steve Armbruster, who refused to arrest some peaceful religious protesters on a campus who were just, you know, they're talking and handing out literature. And so he was ordered to arrest them, and he refused to do that on First Amendment grounds. And so we do pay attention to little stuff, but we really do focus a lot on the big things.
Wow. That is a big thing to the guy standing there wanting to pass out something. I mean, you know that.
Well, you know what I mean. We focus on stuff we consider to be like, you know, hypothetical, you know, far in the future, things like massive civil disarmament of the people and concentration camps and things like that.
But when we come,
because those are the things that can lead to requiring another revolution.
You know, and I'm almost of the mind it's inevitable. Maybe we'll be able to stop it. Maybe the bad guys will get afraid. Maybe they'll be concerned that there's too many damn Oath Keepers out there that won't implement whatever their wishes are. But the one thing that I am certain of, they're going to try. And it's going to be up to individual soldiers and police officers that will resist. And do we need someone like Oath Keepers and Stuart Rhodes causing them pause? Well, I think we do. We need to at least try, and we need to understand it. And we'll understand it some more when we come back with Stuart Rhodes from oathkeepers.org. I got a bunch more questions, and you may too. Call in 866-986-6397. We'll be right back.